Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, one English priest shares with us some thoughts on Pope Benedict XVI's visit to the United Kingdom. And stepping back in time, we bring you echoes of those days when popes were voluntary prisoners in the Vatican. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Friday, 16th of September, marks a year since Pope Benedict XVI's four-day apostolic visit to the United Kingdom, exactly a year ago. Following this successful journey, I spoke to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, who, as you'll hear in a moment, was closely involved in the preparations. In a special way, as you'll hear in a moment, in that meeting on Friday, 17th of September in London, with religious leaders and people of faith, following the encounter with schoolchildren at St Mary's University College, Twickenham. But before listening to Father Peter, why don't I bring you the Pope's words on this visit to the United Kingdom?
Upon arriving in London, I met thousands of Catholic students and school children at a very joyful celebration, reminding all of us of the excellent and essential work being done by the Catholic schools and teachers throughout the land. I then had the pleasure of meeting the clerical and the lay representatives of different religions and of discussing the search for the sacred common to all men.
So having listened to the Pope's words this past Wednesday, let's listen to Father Peter then. So Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, you're currently parish priest in the north of England in the Archdiocese of Liverpool. But you were also pretty involved in Pope Benedict XVI's visit to the United Kingdom. Am I right in saying that?
Yes, mainly in one event, the meeting with people from other religions, but also in the background in a few other things as well. I think it was difficult for me to explain to my people what was going on because a lot of stuff was confidential. And they were just sad that the Pope wasn't coming to the north of England, where most of the Catholics are. But then eventually, I think gradually, people began to understand he's an old man. The programme was already very full. I think the way it was broadcast in the end and the way he spoke, his whole approach, will have won a few hearts and maybe a few people who had been complaining quite a lot because it was hard for them to get to see him. Maybe they will have understood in the end. I think it's been a successful visit and a very happy one.
What struck you most about it?
I've known the Pope as a person for a long time in the sense of seeing him regularly when I worked here in Rome.
As Cardinal Ratzinger.
When he was Cardinal Ratzinger, and I've met him a couple of times since. But what's always struck me about him is his very gentle manner and his serenity. He's a very serene sort of person. It's hard to phase him, as they say. I think some things that do phase him are horrendous things. Like many academics, he has to take time to react to those things. But generally very happy with whatever he has to discuss. And so I saw once again that serene, intelligent, pleasant man that I expected to see. But also, I think he and his advisers had prepared some very good words for a very difficult situation. We're not number one on most people's popularity charts, we Catholics in England at the moment. And I think they expected X, Y and Z and they got A, B and C. There was nothing of the condemnations and nothing of the negative things that people had been forecasting that we would hear. I didn't think we would hear them, but I was so delighted that the tone of approach to living as a Christian in England and Wales and Scotland today came across so positively.
Catholics are a minority in England, aren't they? And they're very conscious of this. It's a very sensitive issue.
Yeah, and there's two kinds of minorities. There are the minorities of people who've been in Catholic families for centuries, so to speak, and there's very recent immigrants. So the immigrants feel that they're part of a minority because of being immigrants, but then they begin to realise that the Catholic Church isn't the big thing in the UK, that it might be in their home country. And then the others, you know, people like myself who were born as Catholics practically, we realise that we are singled out for special treatment in the sense that many people say that Catholics are not allowed to do this, that and the other. The law says that. You know, special jobs. And in another way, you do get the feeling from time to time and over again that, you know, certain things are acceptable, but, oh God, not a Catholic. You know, there still is a very great suspicion of Catholics, and I don't know why it's persisted so long. I know where it came from, but that's a long time ago. And that's one thing. Also, in a country where pluralism is really of the essence, for a community to make claims that we have to behave by certain standards of morality is really sticking your head above the parapet, and that's not made us very popular either. And to add to that, failures to control a very wayward clergy on issues that we all know about have really allowed people to criticise us far more than they might have done in other circumstances. So in many ways, we do feel we're both a minority numerically and also a minority in the sense of not being very popular just at the moment.
Getting back to Pope Benedict's trip, do you think it was felt as a visit to Catholics or more broadly to all the inhabitants of the UK?
Well, there was a great debate, and it was a pretty vicious debate at times, about why the English taxpayer should be funding part of this trip. And there was all sorts of, I think, nonsense, to be honest. But there are, I see people's reasons for saying it. Why is this tiny state counted as a state in the first place? For me, simply, it is because it is. That's the way diplomats regard the Holy See. Countries do accept the Holy See as a state. Whether that's right or wrong, it's just the way it is at the moment. So there was a great discussion, why are we paying for all this? But then, when he was actually there, a lot of the encouragement that he gave in his speeches, I think, was felt by a far broader audience than the Catholics in the country. And in any case, he met the Queen. The first person he met was the Queen. And he also spoke to the great and the good in Westminster Hall. And in the meeting I was at, the meeting with other religions, hardly any Catholics there except the organisers like myself.
Of course, you were very involved in that meeting, weren't you?
I was, yes, in the preparation of it long term. And then,
let's recall how it was on Friday morning at St Mary's University College in Twickenham, no?
Yes. When the Pope arrived, he was greeted by a wonderful sight, because they greeted me just before he came, a huge number of children from the local borough, from all schools, not just Catholic schools. They were just waiting to say hello, and I came past, and it was a lovely atmosphere. So he went through the serried ranks of school children into the chapel and met representatives of religious congregations and religious orders from Britain, and that was the way he began his official day, was to pray with them. Then he met several thousand children and young people in what was called the Big Assembly. For people that don't know the English school system, most schools have an assembly of the whole school at some point in the week, and very often that has a religious tone to it. So the Pope went to the assembly with the children this time, and it was really, really quite remarkable. Then he came to us, another smaller group, a much quieter group, thank goodness, of 100-plus people from other religions, people who had been recognised by all sorts of observers as having contributed a lot to British society, but members of other religions who...
Other religions, meaning?
Hindus, Sikhs, Jews, Muslims, I think there were a couple of Zoroastrians, Jains. There were all sorts of people, and the point was to gather people who, on the basis of their own religious convictions, are prepared to put a lot into society. It was different religions in their own ways contributing to the common good. So what we had to do, we moderators of the different tables of guests, for an hour before the Pope came, was to allow them to discuss certain questions. But really, we didn't need to do much work because they were so keen to talk. And they were all, it turned out, so delighted to have been invited to meet the Holy Father and to hear the Holy Father saying some words of appreciation to them for what they do for society. And to recognise that although we come from very different religious traditions, that should never be a barrier to working together. It was very cleverly orchestrated. The front row at one side, there was an army officer who had his army uniform on, plus his Sikh turban. There was a very beautiful police officer from Birmingham who was working on the Olympics. There were ladies dressed in Hindu costume. There was all sorts. It was really quite a colourful meeting in that outward sense. But also, as I say, people were delighted to have been invited, and they spoke very freely and very honestly, I have to say, on the table I was on, not always agreeing by any means, quite a lot of critical discussion going on. But it was a unique experience in the sense that I don't think that's been done on any papal visit before. And the meeting with the Pope itself was so calm and respectful. It was a pleasure just to witness the crowd of people there. It was very, very nice indeed.
You, of course, wrote the text in the official booklet for this papal trip, which referred to this meeting.
What happened was they produced a booklet which has the text for all the prayers for the Pope's visit. And on the day that we had the meeting of the people from the different religions, they asked
Magnificat,
me simply...
Magnificat, it was called.
It is, yeah, Magnificat. It's a thing that's regularly produced.
The papal visit of Benedict the 16th.
Yeah. And there's one section in there simply where I tried to explain the Catholic Church in dialogue with other religions in Britain. Very short text, but I've already been told that people really have appreciated it.
It's called Dialogue Between the Catholic Church and Other Religions in Britain, and it's on page 159 of this booklet.
Yeah, it's a very short text, but I tried to make the point that because of its history, Britain has so many...
As a seafaring nation.
Yeah, and all our economic and colonial links and the waves of migrants over the centuries have meant that we've had an interreligious dialogue for a long time. In fact, it's not always been plain sailing, but people have lived harmoniously for a long time. There is a threat from people becoming more militant because of, I think, difficult economic circumstances make people's differences stand out further than they should. And there are lots of challenges, but the fact that we could get all those people together and that people could speak so openly was marvellous. And I think what really heartened people at the very beginning of the encounter with the Pope was not only Archbishop Kelly's words, but much more the words of the chief rabbi, who was delighted. The eve of the Feast of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, if you like, the Day of Forgiveness, that Jews and Christians and all sorts of people from other religions could lay things on the table, be straightforward, and make a kind of symbolic gesture of wanting to continue to contribute to society.
Getting back to the trip and the beatification of John Henry Newman, what do you think it was important for the British? Or was it a sort of exclusive to some intellectual event?
I think a lot of people will see Newman as a distant intellectual. But then people who know his life know that he spent a lot of time with poor people and with young people, trying to do his best for the poor people, say, in Birmingham, where he spent many years as a parish priest. I don't know in the long run what dedication to the Blessed John Henry Newman will be. We'll have to see.
Because we see him more as an intellectual figure rather than someone along the lines of St. Philip Neri, no?
Yes, that's true. But I think also for ecumenism it's important to see that Newman was still, after he became a Catholic, very fond of the church in which he grew up spiritually.
There wasn't a break?
He seems to say there wasn't. There was a decision time, but he recognised where his roots lay and what had nourished him in the Anglican communion.
The legacy of this trip, why do you think it will be remembered, for this beatification or for other reasons?
No, I think the beatification will be appreciated, strongly appreciated by lots of people. But I think the main thing will be the desire and the successful attempt to engage with the hearts and minds of ordinary British people, encouraging them not to take second best, but to live their lives according to good standards. And I don't think he was speaking exclusively to Christians. I think his words were to try and help the whole society remain healthy, and or in, where it needs it, to become healthy again. People were so surprised that he had something to say to all of them, and it was said very well.
You got the impression that he felt very much at ease in English culture, no? It's very similar to the German culture, would you say that?
I don't know about that. He's much more at home linguistically in French than in English, but I think since he's been Pope particularly, he's come to appreciate what's going on in our country and maybe also in the United States and other countries of English language tradition. Maybe because he's had more chances to meet people from the different cultures and he's realised there's nothing essentially aggressive about English culture. It's he's, you know, and he's been made very welcome, particularly in Britain, certainly. I think he felt that welcome very much.
Many thanks there to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, a priest from the Liverpool Archdiocese. Meanwhile, on a different note, looking ahead to the 20th of September, which marks almost a century and a half since the defeat of the papacy's temporal power by what became the new nation-state of Italy. It happened during the breach of Porta Pia, one of Rome's fortified gates, when the Piedmontese victoriously entered Rome, having defeated the troops of the Pope of the time, now blessed Pius IX. An occasion which provided me with the opportunity to take you back in time, in an effort to give you a taste of the effects of this major historic event on Papal Rome, on Pius IX, who became a voluntary prisoner in the Vatican, and on the popes who succeeded him to the See of Peter, including Benedict XV, who was elected to the See of Peter in 1914 and who died in 1939, but also on the lives of the members of the families that formed the papal court of the time, the so-called black aristocracy, who in a symbolic gesture closed the doors and windows of their palaces at a time when Rome was rife with horse-drawn carriages rather than cars. But why don't you join me as I step back in time and bring you echoes of that era through the witness of some of those who were actually there. Watch a change of pace and tone.
Up to 1925, only upstarts and Americans were allowed cars. The decent people, as nannies used to say, had carriages. And open carriage in the summer and a closed coupe in the winter. And of course, yes, I even remember the name of the coachman, who was called Baltarelli, and the horse called Nina.
The world of Pope Benedict XV was the same world as the one Father John Charleroux grew up in.
I think my parents had another one. It was the one for the children, for nanny and the nurse and the children.
Your parents had one carriage.
Well, and we had another one. Yes.
And when you drove up to St. Peter's, obviously Via della Conciliazione was... Do you have any memory?
It didn't exist.
Can you describe a little bit how it was?
The Borghi, there was the two side streets. Well, the Borgo Santo Spirito still exists. And there was a parallel one. And then in the middle of the course between the Tiber and St. Peter's Square, there was Piazza Scorsacavallo, on which there was the fountain that is now pushed aside. And then one retook two narrow streets, and then you fell on the spreading out of St. Peter's Square. It was quite sensational. The square looked much wider and much, much larger in those times.
We used to go to Piazza San Pietro when the Pope was nominated. You know, no use going into details. You know, there's a chimney and the black smoke and the white smoke.
You went there as a family, did you, when there was a coronation?
Eventually, yes. Yeah. But we had stands even in those days, even on the Piazza San Pietro.
Did you feel like it was a kind of duty?
It was duty. My parents said, tomorrow we go...
Marquis Mario Teodoli remembered the Pope leaving the Vatican to attend papal ceremonies in the Roman basilicas.
Well, I just had them. My father was a noble guy, so... My father served all the popes up to the day he died. But during the Holy Week, every day, there was a ceremony at the presence of the Pope, not necessarily in the Vatican or St. Peter's, but even in San Giovanni Laterano, as far as I can remember, Santa Croce in Gerusalemme, the big basilicas, St. Paul's. At the presence of the Pope, there were ceremonies, very pompous and everything. And our class had the privilege of having a stand of its own. Once a year, the Holy Father received the Roman nobility, the black. We belonged, as I said, the black. And then everybody stood in line, and the Pope used to walk across this line like that and stop and talk to people.
A At the beginning of each year, the Holy Father received the vows and the diplomatic corps. And after that,
as a child, Count Carlo Cardelli shared similar experiences,
many of which were part of his court as noble guards, Foriere Maggiore, assistant to the Holy See, Monsignori, and so on. The Principe Assistente al Solio, alternatively the chief of the house of Colonna or Orsini, introduced the very numerous audience to the Holy Father, who replied to his address with hearty comments and encouragements, after which he stopped with each family group, informing himself and granting special blessings to personal charitable activities of many. Children were also present. This very touching personal direct contact with His Holiness was not only important for each of us, it was also an opportunity to know each other better and to feel united as a group by a common tradition of loyalty to the Pope.
We weren't a black family, we weren't all connected with the Vatican in any way. In fact, we used to get the invitation to the tribune of the Roman nobility, then my father declined it at one stage.
Despite counting no less than a pope among her ancestors, Princess Doria Pamphili's family didn't belong to the black aristocracy.
Or something, or a poster that the pope was inviting everyone to join him on such a day, and one went along. Of course, there were very few people in Rome at that time. 1870, when Rome became the capital of Italy, the pope retreated to the Vatican. The black nobility, the ones that shut their doors on the state, on the Italian state, and stuck with the pope, and the white were the ones who went with the state. And as my great-grandfather was the first deputy mayor of Rome in 1870, of course, we were with the state and not with the Vatican.
As the son of a French diplomat to the Holy See, Father Charles Leroux mixed with the children of the black aristocratic families.
Those people had all their shutters and doors closed on the facade. We were not allowed when we went out as children to doff our cap to the Italian flag. Many of the palaces, I remember the Massimo Palace on the Corso, were always entered by the back. And there were some others who had more, less gorgeous palaces, but houses, like the Manassés, who were very, very black. When all entered the black, all that was on Rome was closed. We used to go with the Torlonias. Nannies didn't like us to go into public gardens, so went to private garden, and there was the Villa Medici, of course, which was a very private garden, since it depends on the French Academy. And we used to come back from Villa Medici, and then take the Via 20 Settembre to come back to the center of the town. But the coachman had the order, when he heard the music for the change of the guard, I mean the flag, to take any side street for us not to meet the Italian flag. They are called black because the women went to court in the Vatican with black veils, whereas the tradition of the court of Savoy is that women went in white veils. Hence, one side was called the whites and the other side was called the blacks. And, well, the blacks part of them were owners of the lands. For instance, the Colonnas, the Orsinis had fortresses everywhere, and they were the feudal aristocracy of the country. So some others had made their career by being servants of the Vatican court. So they were all attached to the idea of the Pope being the King of Rome. And when the invaders came in, they called them the Piemontese.
Prince Francesco del Drago, Father Charles Leroux said, was standing on the rooftop of his palace when the Italian troops entered Rome.
But none of you have seen so great a catastrophe and disaster as what I saw. So we all asked him, Zio Francesco, what was that? Well, on a day of September, I was on the terrace on the roof of Villa del Drago, which was where the station is now. And you know what I saw? I saw the Italians enter Rome. It was the end of the world. So that was the mentality of the black aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
While in 1919, following the First World War, the families of the black aristocracy that formed the papal court were shut in behind the closed windows and doors of their palaces, while the Pope himself was shut in his office in the Vatican, concerning himself with matters such as the code of canon law, the canonization of Joan of Arc, or the stability of Europe, out at sea, the man who was to be a close friend of Pope Benedict XV's successor was experimenting with radio waves.
My father always had a great passion for the sea because he crossed the Atlantic 87 times, always for his work. Because in 1901, he made his first transmission across the Atlantic from Paul Dew Cornwall to St. John, Newfoundland.
Princess Elettra, Guglielmo Marconi's daughter, was named after the yacht from which her father used to send out his wireless messages.
He built in Cornwall. He named the yacht Elettra for the electric waves. That he felt that the electric waves was the radio, so his invention. My father, through his invention, the radio, saved many human lives.
It was on board the Elettra that Marconi told his daughter how in 1912 he'd helped save some of the passengers of the great ocean liner Titanic when on its maiden voyage to New York it struck an iceberg.
And then it started to sink. And the radio man on board was asking for help with SOS. They heard the signal of help and they came. They succeeded in bringing and saving the lives of all these 700 passengers. And my father, who was in New York, he went to the docks because through the radio he was following what was going on. And so he went to receive the rescuers. People were crying and they were screaming and hugging him and kissing him because they were so grateful, so happy that he had been able to save their lives.
And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.